This is a Carlisle ValueCast, brought to you by the Carlisle Group. ValueCast brings you insights from our One Carlisle Network, providing analysis, data, and observations to help you navigate the global economy and top-of-mind issues in news. The Carlisle Group. Invest wisely. Create value.
Good morning. My name is Glenn Youngkin, and I'm the co-president and co-chief operating officer at Carlisle. Today, we're discussing the energy investment picture. I'm joined today by the three gentlemen who lead Carlisle's private equity funds that invest across the energy spectrum around the world. Ken Hirsch, who's the CEO and managing partner and co-founder of NGP Energy Capital Management. Ken's also a senior advisor to Carlisle and serves on our management committee. Bob Mancini, who's the managing director and co-head of Carlisle Power Partners. And Marcel Van Puca, who's a managing director and head of Carlisle International Energy Partners. So first, Marcel, energy policy issues in Europe, and you mentioned the developments with Russia and the differential of fracking outlooks and the decline of support for nuclear. Can you just give us a sense, with all of that happening, really where are the opportunities that you're seeing across Europe right now?
There's one other factor there, which is important to mention also, that's the whole cap and trade, so the carbon credits. That system was set up in Europe originally at a price of somewhere 25, 30 euros per ton as a penalty on CO2 emissions. And that system has basically collapsed, and it's still there. It's trading at 5 euros, but it's clearly, it doesn't give the signal which the politicians originally wanted, and the main reason that the system has collapsed is that the different countries don't agree on the policy. Now, what that has done is increase the amount of coal which Europe is using, because at the end of the day, you need electricity. Yes, there is wind. Yes, there is solar, but it is all relatively small. So I think we are going to see investment opportunities and good markets for oil, especially for gas also, but I think we also see increased coal consumption. And interestingly enough, most of that coal has been coming the last couple of years from the U.S. We have seen where it's been pushed out by gas, of course. So we've seen more and more coal. We've even seen the consumption going up the first 6 months of this year. So I think infrastructure related to that, but also, and more importantly, on the natural gas side in the North Sea. I think those are the big opportunities.
Marcel, I recently met with one of the senior folks from the UK Ministry of Finance, and they're really pushing hard to actually try to open up the fracking opportunities. I think they recently, in fact, offered license opportunities. What's happening in the UK from a fracking opportunity? And do you view that as something that will present itself in the near term as a good investment opportunity?
I think what you see in the UK, the UK has very good resources. Small number of companies are active, but not very successfully so far, because every time they start drilling in a small, nice little English village, then 10,000 people come down and basically block everything. And so far they've done that successfully. So yes, there is an opportunity. Yes, the government is supportive. But so far, we haven't seen successful drilling. So what it means, Glenn, is that we are following it, but are very careful to put money at work there right now, because this could take a while. And the only good country in Europe where we see this is the UK. The other country, which is sort of European, not so clear anymore now, where Shell and Chevron committed big investment dollars, was the Ukraine, and especially in Eastern Ukraine. But with all that's happening, that's not going to materialize either. So I don't see any short-term opportunities, but especially in the UK, it's a space we're watching very carefully.
And does the conflict with Russia truly cause any disruption to natural gas supply into Europe, or is that just always going to be above and beyond any political issues?
Well, so far, Gazprom is not supplying Ukraine. European gas prices are low because we had a very very mild winter. But most people are very worried about this winter. So we see a very serious winter-summer spread. The CEO of Total has warned and said we could have see really, really big problems this winter because of that. So we'll have to see. But so far what you see, Glenn, is that the tension with Russia is ratcheting up very, very quickly. People have gotten very emotional, understandably, and angry about the downing of this commercial flight. So if there will be more sanctions, it can only get worse. It will not get better on the short term.
Great. And Ken, as we discuss fracking and roll over to the U.S., the unconventional revolution is well through the revolutionary stage. We continue to hear media reports of concerns around fracking and water usage. Do you see any disruption to the continued use of those technologies and therefore the exploitation of the reserves in the U.S.?
At a super high level, 32 states now produce oil and gas in the United States, and there's a few more states that are capable of it but that for political reasons choose not to. So it's no longer just the Republican Texans and Oklahomans against the rest of the country or anything like that. So that's why it's taken off so dramatically, is that it really has become the single largest contributor to the U.S. GDP growth. So that political reality and economic reality sort of trumps, in my mind, the fear factor of fracking. And so I like to point people to the facts and say that if done responsibly, fracking is just a shortening of the words hydraulic fracture stimulation, which is think of it as the construction process of a natural gas well or an oil well. And the construction process in general, if done well and done responsibly, can be done safely. Of course, there is human error and there are accidents, but we've been fracking wells in the United States for the last 60 years. And we've been drilling horizontally for over 25 years. And so the amount and the numbers belie the overall systemic risk. So I think that a lot of things are happening in the industry that are very, very exciting and have a lot of momentum. There's noise around it. We have to be careful, but if done right, I think it'll continue.
All right. So, Bob, picking up from some points from Marcel and from Ken, we're in an environment with, in the U.S., low gas prices, as everybody has discussed, high coal demand in Europe because they have a much more compressed overall supply situation. We've got the EPA, as you described, really releasing new rules to encourage the reduction of CO2. So when you blend all that together, what's the future of coal in power generation in the United States?
Coal historically has been more than 50% of the fuel supply to produce power in the U.S., and today it's somewhere in the 37% range. It's probably headed to somewhere in the range of less than 30% over the next couple of decades. Coal is just not economic to compete with cheap gas. The other impact, of course, is the EPA rules and other state regulations, which are making it more difficult, more expensive to run coal plants. But the fact of the matter is that there are some situations where coal can compete, particularly coal that's been scrubbed, that take out mercury and NOx and SOx. And in those situations, it's where the coal is located relative to the plant. So if your fuel supply, if your plant is sitting on top of your fuel supply and you don't have any material transportation costs, then you're more likely to survive very low gas prices. So there are many places where coal will continue to exist and continue to compete successfully, either because it's cheap or because gas isn't readily available.
Perfect. Thanks. And so I just want to finish out a little bit of a global tour. And Marcel, just ask you if you could just please comment on China, and particularly whether there really are investment opportunities there or not?
I think we are very, very, very careful. I think you can't compare it in any way to the United States. We've seen disappointing results, major oil companies who have been drilling.
Okay, so really no near-term investment opportunities in your sense?
No.
Okay. Bob, as you look at the power spectrum, you spent a little bit of time talking about New England and the shortage of kind of supply network into New England. How does that existing infrastructure impact the way you see the power markets developing around the United States?
Well, let's start with New England. You know, it's become a greater focus for investors over this past winter because we saw the effects of the polar vortex and the fact that there's a real lack of adequate gas infrastructure to supply gas into New England, particularly around the Boston area. Gas was being diverted to places like New York. Until that gas infrastructure is built out, it's really going to highlight the fact that it may be more difficult than people thought to close down coal plants as readily as they'd like to in New England, and also going to, of course, continue to have New England rely on fuel oil as one of its primary fuel sources to power its power plant. If you look at a market like PJM, where the Marcellus shale formations exist, you would think that there's an opportunity to build as many gas plants as you want and be able to displace as many coal plants as you want. But the problem is twofold. One is the gas could exist, but the gas pipeline may not be fully developed, or there may be too much congestion on the gas pipeline to be able to move the gas to the location of the plant. If the plant is sitting on top of a gas formation, it may be sitting in the middle of a cow field where really nobody lives. And so what the challenge is, how do you move the power to where the load exists? And that gets to the transmission question. And in this country, transmission is in most cases 100 years old, and we haven't really adequately invested in upgrading our transmission system. And so a lot of times we'll have an ability to build a power plant at the source of a gas supply, but then have no place to evacuate the power. So there's a lot of high-fiving around the fact that we're producing as much gas as we are and, in theory, able to build more gas plants. We still have to upgrade our transmission system.
Ken, given the fact that there is an absolute differential in existing infrastructure, and let's just call it midstream infrastructure around the various basins, where do you see the biggest gap today in existing midstream capabilities versus what's needed?
The biggest gap would be in the Northeast. The Marcellus Shale, it has been quite impressive how it has beaten almost all the estimates. Today, it produces between 12 and 14 BCF a day, and there's certain estimates that it'll go, that has the potential to go in excess of 20. That could happen. It does need a lot of infrastructure, the processing plants, the pipelines, and just the replumbing then of the direction of where the gas is going to go has to be sorted out before you get all the pipelines in. The question needs to be, if you're a pipeline operator, are you going to put a pipeline from the Marcellus to go from the mid-Atlantic states to the East Coast to fuel power plants there, or is it going to be more of a line that goes down to the Gulf Coast or to the Southeast for either power or for industrial uses? So you're starting to see, as Bob said, the market's responding. There's construction underway in the Northeast. There's construction underway in the Texas and Louisiana Gulf Coast, and I think those are the two big areas from the industrial side. And then, as Bob mentioned, the power side, natural gas-fired power plants, are in need in Texas and in California and in the Southeast and in the Northeast. So we're in the second inning, I think, of a nine-inning game here on in terms of infrastructure build, which is going to lead to gas demand, and it's quite exciting.
Marcel, do we expect that Europe will return to nuclear power as Japan is starting to do? And Bob, what's the outlook for nuclear in the U.S.? So first, Marcel.
No, I don't see that that happening. It's a totally different situation than Japan. If you look at, for instance, France, which now also started to phase down 85% of electricity comes from nuclear. I mean, that was never a good idea to begin with in terms of risks, and it's clear that the trend is going down, and the government just started that. You also see in the Benelux, of course, much smaller, that there is no public support for nuclear, and that's the same thing with Germany. Germany has a lot of very strong nuclear opposition. So it will be very difficult for politicians to do that. So I think this is a long-term trend.
Bob, in the U.S., any new developments on nuclear that are worth noting?
Well, look, I think there's three reasons why the future of nuclear in the U.S. is probably pretty bleak. The first is, of course, the political/emotional response. Fukushima reminded people of what can happen. Three Mile Island, for those who can remember that, was a sort of a near miss, but could have been a tremendous disaster. San Onofre in California, the largest nuclear plant in California, was shut down last year because of risks around safety and reliability of the integrity of the plant. So Indian Point is under pressure in New York, and as far as the construction of new nuclear, I think the emotional political issue, not in my backyard, those types of issues are going to weigh very heavily. The second is the fact that gas actually, in many cases, can compete pretty significantly with nuclear. It costs a lot to run a nuclear plant. The third thing is the cost of building these plants. What history has shown us and experience has shown us is that there are always cost overruns, and they're never marginal. They're always many multiples. So I think the future of nuclear is rather dubious in this country.
Thanks. One question, Bob, staying with you for a minute, has to revisit whether there are opportunities in wind and solar, et cetera, that are worth pursuing, and how you're thinking about that from an investment opportunity.
Well, it depends on what you're thinking about in terms of your return profile. If you're focused on a return profile that targets somewhere around the high single digits and maybe 10% on a levered basis, then wind and solar could be a good opportunity. However, there's a couple of cautionary notes. One is both those types of projects without subsidies really in most cases can't compete with conventional thermal resources, particularly gas. In some cases, wind can compete, but it tends to be in places where people don't live. So the other thing that's happened is a lot of the opportunities in solar in particular were reliant upon utilities writing long-term contracts. Those are becoming fewer and fewer as the utilities have been reaching their goals and standards that are being set at the local level for renewable resources on the system. So without those long-term contracts, you're seeing fewer and fewer of the utility scale solar projects being put in place. There's been a transition in the solar market really to more rooftop, and without a mechanism to aggregate, it's hard to really make a sizable, scalable investment in that space.
Marcel, can you comment about oil and gas opportunities in Africa, and specifically, do you see Nigeria, Angola, Mozambique, Madagascar, to name a few, playing any critical roles in the future of the oil and gas sector? And if so, how are people approaching it?
I think East Africa is clearly the new gas, and it starts to be also some oil province. But it's a lot of development. It's something we are staying away from. We like much more production or very near-term production. In West Africa, it's different. It's those are mature oil fields producing provinces. I think there are interesting opportunities. And for us, what is very interesting and very exciting is that Carlyle is present there with offices, with people on the ground, which help evaluating opportunities. So a lot of deals there, major oil companies, again, pulling out, main reason allocating capital to the U.S. and these big projects, the new big projects. So clearly an opportunity. Forget North Africa. I think even in countries in North Africa where there is not a problem yet, I mean, we're staying away from those countries.
And Ken, what's deal volume look like this year across at least the North American industry?
The M&A volume in the first half of the year of 14 has already equaled the entire year of 13. So lots of transactions, lots of velocity, lots of activity.
And Marcel, in the European and African and North Sea world, what are you seeing?
Well, take Ken's picture and multiply it. So more capital needed and less funds. Also more M&A transactions first 6 months. And that is driven by those big divestments like we talked about before. And there are very few funds investing in this space.
Bob, do you have a measure or a number on what you expect from a generation capacity standpoint will be closed or taken offline nationally or by region over the next few years due to new regs or things not being re-permitted?
The numbers that most people are citing are about 80,000 megawatts. That's enough power to power nearly 100 million homes. It's a massive amount of power that's going to have to get repowered. So that's primarily driven by environmental regulations. So we're going to see a significant amount of coal coming out of the system, and it's going to have to be replaced by something, and that'll be gas.
And while I've got you, Bob, are there any trends in the deployment of smart transmission technology that you think will change the localized nature of the grids?
A lot of people are talking about microgrids and very local, inside-the-fence type of production. I think Hurricane Sandy emphasized the fact that having your sort of local self-reliance, I think that only goes so far. I mean, it's one thing to put a generator in your backyard. It's another to power an entire city block. So I think the notion of microgrids and will have some impact around the edges, but it's really not going to have an impact on the overall system.
Okay, thanks. Just a couple closing thoughts. There were a number of key highlights, just the tremendous capital needs that the broader energy sector consumes and the supply-demand balance, which is pretty favorable to organizing private pockets today, and that's fundamentally why so much capital is moving to the sector. It's a very localized business, and it's interesting to compare the various geographies and the opportunities, although there are some generally favorable trends as the movement of fuel sources begins to open up a bit around the world. Government regulations will continue to be an important part of the overall scene and one that both we have to keep abreast of, but also creates some very interesting opportunities. And once again, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. For more information, go to our website at www.carlyle.com. This has been a Carlyle ValueCast podcast.